Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now our guest is a returning guest, Dr. Peter Lilback. I had the privilege of writing the book, George Washington's Sacred Fire, with Dr. Peter Lilback. And in this segment, what we want to do is focus on some of the objections that some people raise on the idea that George Washington was a Christian. Dr. Lilback, welcome back to the program. So good to have you on again.
Well, Jerry, it's always a pleasure, and I'm really so grateful for our partnership through the years.
All right. Now, George Washington as a Christian, some people say, well, look, the man owned slaves. What's your comment to that?
There's no doubt that he owned slaves, and so we have to take a careful look and consider this matter of slavery. First of all, as we know, when we read the Bible, when the Jewish people were going through the Exodus and they left Egypt, they had been an enslaved nation. And when they were able to get to Mount Sinai and the Ten Commandments were given, it's amazing when the first laws are given right after that, it had to do with how do you handle slaves. And so what is amazing, a slave nation now needed to figure out how are you going to deal with this universal problem of humans owning other humans. It's been part of the ancient world all the way to antiquity, and the Bible was in the process of beginning to change a cultural reality that needed to be ultimately eradicated, but it couldn't happen overnight. And so we can see that it's actually in this biblical root. And so when people were Bible readers, they were saying, well, the Bible allows slaves, right? Yes, it did. But it began to try to civilize slavery until ultimately it would show that even slaves should be viewed as family and the institution itself should eventually be eradicated by the freedom of the gospel.
And could I stop you real fast? Would it be fair to say, too, that sometimes when the Bible, especially the Old Testament, is talking about slavery, we could really truthfully substitute the phrase indentured servanthood, in other words, where somebody would be a slave or whatever, they would give their labor, but it would only be for a short time, and then once that time was finished, then they were freed. And that's one type of slavery, but there's the evil type of slavery condemned in Exodus, where the Egyptians were enslaving the Hebrews and pretending like they were owning them, if you will, and that would be equivalent. What the Egyptians did to the Hebrews would be the equivalent to what unfortunately happened to the Americans, you know, in the American experience of slavery. Your comment on that?
I think the first point is that we want to say is that there's a difference between chattel slavery, where a human being is just considered an object and a non-person.
And that's evil according to the Bible.
And that's evil according to the scriptures. A slave was viewed as a human being that had rights and had the right to be protected. And so what we see is that the Bible is beginning to civilize an evil practice and making it improve. That's what the Bible does. It improves things. Now, over time, this process, as Christianity is working out, slavery began to be addressed, but it hadn't fully been addressed. And so one of the tragedies of the New World is that slavery was one of the engines of economic growth. So why do I say all that? When Washington is born as the fourth generation of Washingtons in Virginia, the institution of slavery was not only ancient, but it had been enculturated in Virginia because it was how civilization was being established. You needed a lot of hard work, and slaves were owned, and the African slave trade was going on. And whenever there's this process of owning a human being, even with alleged rights, there's always abuses, and abuses were part of it. So first of all, we want to say it's ancient. It was trying to be reformed early on in the Bible, but it was culturally placed, and that was Washington's experience. So we can find the early Washington actually in his record saying, well, take this slave. He's giving me so much problems to the Caribbean. Sell him for limes and molasses and other things and bring him back. Cavalier slaveholder. Now, something happens as Washington begins to engage the struggle with the British, as he begins to see that his rights are going to be stripped away just by the government fiat. The famous line, no taxation without representation. And while Washington never writes that phrase, he recognizes the danger of his own life becoming a slave to a government far away, where they can simply begin to take your property without your voice. Yeah. And he didn't want to be a slave. And so the first act of resisting slavery was his signing on for the Fairfax Resolves. Basically, these were the non-importation of slaves. He said, we're not going to take any more slaves from the British. Now, that was not motivated at this stage so much by being opposed to the slave trade as opposed to anything that was doing with the British. But in that process, the seed was planted in his mind. If I don't want to be a slave, how can I have slaves?
Yeah.
If slavery is something I'm opposed to for myself, what about my own slaves? Well, that issue begins to work in his mind so that by the time the war is over, we have the interesting account where the Methodist bishops actually come and visit now retired General Washington at home, and they say, we are beginning to work toward the abolition and ending of slavery in America. Will you help us? And according to their interview with Washington, he says, I know slavery is wrong. I know it needs to end. I'm not in government at this point, and which was true, he said, so I have no ability to address these issues. But his belief was is that we must begin to change this. And so part of what we know is that at this stage, Washington is beginning to actually improve the status of his slaves by giving them education, by giving them trades. And so he's beginning to plant, if you will, the first steps toward what would be necessary for freedom.
Yeah.
But now what we find at the end of Washington's life, after being a president, and yes, he did have slaves when he came to Philadelphia, which was a free state, but he brought his slaves with him. He is wrestling with these issues of how can I operate my household with slaves, without slaves? It's wrong. What am I going to do? At the end of his life, with about 2 or 3 years left, he sits down and he writes his will. And in his will, he says, I want to provide for my slaves that are my own. At the death of my wife, I want them all to be freed.
Mm.
I'm going to provide for them, for their freedom. And he especially names his body servant, Billy Lee, and provides for him a direct bequest to care for him because he'd become his personal lifelong friend. And so Washington ultimately finally overcomes slavery in his will by saying, I'm freeing my own slaves and I'm providing for them. And so he becomes the only slave-owning president who ever freed his slaves by his own initiative rather than because of the Civil War or the Emancipation Proclamation. And I would be so bold as to say this. If the other Southern slaveholders had followed Washington's model of freeing their slaves at their death and providing for them, there would have been no Civil War, and slavery would have ended. It would have ended peacefully. Washington, at this area where we can most attack him for being culturally inappropriate, utterly politically and morally incorrect by any vantage point today, by the time his life is ending, he's recognized it's wrong. He's moved from his moral indifference to his moral conviction, and he addresses it. And so even at this point, he is a wonderful role model for us. I hope at the points where we are morally inappropriate, that by the time we come to the end of our life, we've addressed them, seeking to be right before God.
Excellent.
So he's still a hero, a bruised hero to be sure, but even at this point, he is a man of honor more than most of us, I think, when it comes to issues of moral impropriety.
All right, good. We're looking at objections to the idea that George Washington was a Christian, and I thank you so much. That is such an important point that you've just made. Now, these other ones, we'll have to deal with them in a quicker way just because of the time restraints, but sometimes the idea is brought up that George Washington was a Mason, and Masons sometimes teach things that are contrary to the Word of God. So how do you deal with that, sir?
Well, there's no question Washington was a Mason, and his letters and his life shows that. Now, here's what's interesting. In an earlier conversation, we had spoken about the fact that Washington was a sermon collector.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the collections of sermons he had were called his Masonic Sermons. And it seems strange, but it was once or twice a year, the Masonic fraternities in America at this history would invite the great gospel preachers in to preach a sermon. And many times these sermons would be published, and they were circulated, and Washington collected them. The reason that it's important is they give us an insight into the kind of Masonic movement that was going on in America. I remember going to a Masonic encyclopedia as we were doing our research, and one of the things it says is that there is a form of a masonry called the Christian Mason. It says Christianity is an evangelizing religion, and when it has an impact on a body, it Christianizes it. And so there was a movement called Christian Masons in America. I don't know that they exist today because I'm not a Mason or a son of a Mason. I don't want to be a Mason, nor do I counsel anybody to be one.
Right.
But what is interesting is that Washington in his sermons actually quotes, or one of the quotes in one of the sermons says, I want to give you the bylaws of our Masonic fraternity. It says, quote, no stupid atheist or deist may be a member of our Masonic order because we are Christian Masons. In other words, rather than being a proof that Washington was a deist because he was a Mason, the very sermon with the orders of the bylaws says you can't be a Mason if you're a deist because they were Christians. Yeah. One of the sermons actually goes like this, and I'll have to summarize it quickly. The preacher says, you may think you're going to get into heaven because you've worn the robe of Calvin or the robe of Luther, but I want to assure you, your vestments won't get you into heaven. Some of you think you're going to get into heaven because you've worn the apron of a Mason. I assure you, no Masonic apron is going to get you into heaven. If you want to get into heaven, you must be clothed in the righteousness of Jesus Christ, received by faith alone. When I read that, I said, my goodness, that's a sermon I can preach in my own pulpit as a gospel preacher.
Isn't that amazing?
Kind of
and it's my understanding that later, long after George Washington died, sometime in the 1830s or so, there were some Masons that arose that basically became very anti-Christian in their outlook, and that's where the discrepancy could be made. But it's historically inaccurate to, put Washington in that category. Plus, one other quick thing, John Eidsmo, author of the book Christianity and the Constitution, noted that George Washington's Masonic commitment wasn't even that strong, in the sense that he said that in a period of 40 years, he probably went to the lodge about four times, which would be about once every decade. Okay, we have a couple minutes to wrap up on objections to the idea that George Washington was a Christian. So I'd like to ask you about communion. It's my understanding that early in his life, he participated in the Lord's Supper. Later in life, he didn't do it on a regular basis. Your comments, sir?
Well, first of all, it's true. Washington was not a frequent communion participant at any point in his life. And the reason for that is the low church Anglicans of Virginia were not, if you will, the high church Episcopalian Anglicans that we're familiar with that have the Lord's Supper or communion at every worship service. Hmm. They would actually have a communion service that was maybe quarterly, maybe annually, and it was the custom for many Virginians to have communion once a year and feel that that was appropriate.
Wow.
We could criticize that, but it was not a common practice to start with because that was their tradition in the low church. Secondly, while Washington was a member of the church, he actually is a church warden and a vestryman, and the records show that he actually bought the communion wine for the use in the worship services. He paid for a pew, and he actually bought the organ for his church. And he was one of the church leaders. He paid tithes regularly, so he was very much a churchman. The question is, what happened when the war came? Well, the problem for Washington, like many in the Anglican Church,
1 minute to wrap
up. They went to worship. They were worshiping in a church that the head of the church was the king. And when you declare the king to be a tyrant, it's very difficult to take communion in that church because either the minister priest doesn't want you to partake because you're out of communion with the head of the church, or because you don't want to partake there because you don't want to say the prayers for the king. So this was a very difficult time. But we do know, to make a long story short, that Mrs. Alexander Hamilton actually tells us that on the inauguration day when Washington took his oath of office, after this happened in New York City, they went to a small chapel nearby. And she said, I knelt today and took communion with the newly inaugurated President of the United States. So he was not a man who was opposed to the communion service. And actually, there's an eyewitness account by Mrs. Alexander Hamilton. So
right.
He was not a frequent communion person. He did have a problem with the leader of the Episcopal Church, newly established in Philadelphia. He was here because he destroyed the American Book of Common Prayer that celebrated July 4th as a holy day.
Mm.
Washington was upset, I'm sure, when that was taken out as a special day, because that was the whole story of his career. It was removed. And so I think in protest, he probably did not commune when that minister was leading the service.
All right.
Those are some of the interpretations that
sure.
provides.
Exactly. And we've been talking with Dr. Peter Lilback. The book that we co-wrote together is called George Washington's Sacred Fire. Thank you so much, Dr. Lilback, for being with us. ProvidenceForum.org for more information.